The following is a production of Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary. For more information about the seminary, visit us online at gpts.edu.
But the verb that is used is the same word that is used elsewhere for pastors. So the usage of the verb should determine for us how the word pastor should be designated. It should designate all the elders in their oversight, not just the teaching elder. The teaching elder, when he's called a distinguishing functionary, should be called a teacher. Or, of course, the word servant, or in which the word diakonos is also used in a broad sense, to mean servant or minister. You can call him that too. So now you need to look at one other place that will help us in this kind of pilgrimage we're going through. And that place is 1 Corinthians, 12th chapter, if my memory serves me correctly. You never know about this memory. 1 Corinthians chapter 12. Okay. In this chapter, you see that we have a distinction between among various people. And in this section, we don't have any reference to elders per se. But in verse 28, we have apostles, prophets, third, teachers. Then it goes on to describe miracles, gifts of healing, helping, administrating, and various kinds of tongues. Now, in my judgment, the Apostle Paul describes a threefold way of describing the offices there, leaving aside the supernatural and extraordinary gifts of healing and tongues and miracles. He describes them as teachers, administrators, and helpers. Or he actually describes them as teachers, helpers, and administrators. And if you recognize that, you'll recognize that we have a threefold office described here. These are the words teachers. They're already described. Helpers are the deacons, and the ruling elders are administrators. So that you have in this list teachers, actually then helpers second, and then third administrators. And administrators are those who are particularly responsible for ruling. Teachers are particularly responsible to teach. But it doesn't mean they shouldn't also rule, and it doesn't mean that minister people don't also aren't able to teach. The helpers are doing what the deacons do, they're helping other people. So how does the Bible describe this? Well, most clearly it describes them as a twofold function. But when you also throw into this mix Ephesians 4:11 passage, but also throw in Timothy and Titus, who were the models for us ministers, not just ruling elders, but ministers and teachers, then you can see you can refer to it as either in a twofold way or a threefold way. But you should never give up either side of the equation. If you give up either side of the equation, you give up what the Bible has revealed for our instruction. And remember that people most often think of the twofold description as the clearest indication of the office of the church. Philippians 1:1, overseers and deacons. 1 Timothy 3, overseer and deacons. But if you put in the refinement of 1 Timothy 5, 7, Ephesians 4:11, 5:17, or Ephesians 4:11, 1 Corinthians 12:28, and work all these things together, including that passage of teacher's praise, then you can recognize that you can actually look at them in a threefold way. So I hope that you are 2.5 office people. And that you'll preserve both sides. You won't let that side make a hierarchy in which the minister is more important than the elder. He is, in one sense, of course, but he has more gifts and abilities. And he's trained for those and he served to pay for those. So I acknowledge all those. But he can be described as a fellow elder, as Peter did. He did not less apostle because he described it as a fellow elder. And so you should see the whole mix. And don't let anybody get you on either side of the tug of war. Just one of them would say, I think both of you are right, and you understand the vertical merit correctly. There may be some nuances we may have missed in this, and I'd be helped. I hope to be helpful in them if I have overlooked some passages. But I think then you can explain that those other passages that talk about you should be leaders, you should give attention to their oversight and their teaching skills. Those other nuances which describe elders or overseers, not with office terms, but with terms of description, their duty. And it's an interesting phenomenon, as often as we have an overseer or presbyter or deacon, Paul a couple of times in 1 Thessalonians, and the writer of Hebrews, and Hebrews, a couple of places in the letter to Hebrews, describes the officers, I think primarily teachers, when he's using the language, except one place in Hebrews, where he doesn't even use the designation. So that's because he's confident to do that. I mean, it is confident. Okay, let's pick up now with that little backdrop, which wasn't so. I didn't want to argue the office case so clearly in the commentary that I think people will thought, oh, he's getting off on some Presbyterian jag there. And this is supposed to be written to be helpful to everybody. So I came close, but I didn't do it quite as detailed as I did it here. Now let's go back and look at what I have. 1 Timothy 3:13 thus presents a twofold pattern for the official ministry of the church, that of oversight and that of service. The same twofold pattern is also seen in Philippians 1:1. Seem to be reflecting the early division of labor in Jerusalem with the oversight ministry of the apostles of prayer and of ministry of the word, Acts 6:1-4, and the aid to widows on the part of the seven, verses 1-3 of Acts 6. The early Jerusalem community presents not only a conceptual parallel, but also a linguistic parallel. One, Peter, one of the apostles, can refer to himself as a fellow elder. Let us assume joined to the pres. Buteros, on page 175, if you want to follow along. That elder was a synonym for episkopos. It's clear from Titus 1:5 and 7, Acts 20:17-28, and you need to compare these verses from 1 Peter 5:2 and 1 Timothy 5:17. And I commend you the Valid City of Lightfoot, the synonyms. Bishop and presbyter in the commentary on Philippians. The Anglicans were so upset because Lightfoot had stated there was a synonym. And in another edition, I think they had in the added word, history has shown us you can talk about an archival bishop over against presbyter. Which I thought that's not much evidence for me. But he did talk about the synonyms of bishop and presbyter in the commentary on Philippians, which was one. Can't quote a better source than that than having Bishop Lightfoot talk about his synonyms of bishop. Well, that's the first one. Peter, one of the elders, apostles. Secondly, the responsibility for which the seven were elected, referred to as the daily diaconia without further qualification. And their activity is described as diaconein trapezes, that is, serving tables, Acts 6:12. Linguistic connection with those who are in 1 Timothy 3, 8-13 described with the noun diakonoi and the verb diakonei used in technical sense is striking is in accord with the division of labor in conceptual terms in Acts 6. In other words, I don't want someone to say, we don't know who the seven are. Now, technically, it's true, they're not called deacons. But when you analyze what we learn about the responsibility of the offices by analyzing their titles, overseers are to oversee, presbyters are to be elder people who oversee, and deacons are to be those who are serving, because that's the meaning of them from the verb which the noun is derived. Then when you see them serving and ordained to the office, it seemed to me ridiculous to leave them out as some a special category in the book of Acts that has no reference to us. I think you'll see them as the early and first deacons. So the office is divided, and I think it answers questions because Titus makes no reference to deacons at all, because it is an early evangelized area in the Isle of Crete, where they have to go back after the evangelization, establish deacons, elders, or bishops in every church. And so just like in the beginning of the church, it's still true today, you can have a church, on the one hand, it has no officers at all, and Titus 1, the Isle of Crete, even though it's lacking, as the Apostle Paul says, lacking some order. You can have them with only an apostle, apostolic group or overseers, as I think Titus clearly does. So you're trying to get the thing up and running, so you get that accomplished first. They can do the after work as the apostle did. So it becomes so cumbersome, you see when they're gifted by the other work, and you split off the responsibility. But when you split it off, you do it exactly as was done in Acts 6. You elect a group of men, you assign them this task, and you leave that task, and set it aside, or have them give that task over to the deacons, and now the overseers and they're doing the overseeing. But anyway, I want to make that point here, that the seven is clearly in the act of seven. And so I say that 1 Peter 5:1, Acts 6:12, and 1 Timothy 3:8-13, these three passages show then a twofold division of labor in early, middle, and later times in the New Testament church. So what is the early, middle, and later times? Well, Acts 6 is the early time. Philippians is the middle time. And the pastorals are the later time. And whatever time period you plunge into, you have what we would call the Presbyterian arrangement prescribed by the Apostle Paul. And not only do you find it in the early, middle, and later time period, New Testament church, you find it in key cities in three various geographical areas. In Palestine, Acts 6, in Greece, and about Philippians 1:1, and in Asia Minor, in terms of Ephesus, in which the pastoral letter is addressed. And in both Jewish and Greco-Roman settings. I'm saying, without trying to overstate it in the commentary here, that whatever time period you go to in the early church, whatever area you go to in the early church, you have this kind of twofold description for us. That's rather significant. Look in 1:1, 1 Timothy 3, and Acts 6. But it is puzzling that such an early and widespread phenomenon is otherwise virtually absent from the rest of the New Testament, at least in terms of the diaconoi, although not entirely so in terms of the episcopoi and presbyteroi. So I want to also combat people who say, it may be important to you, but I don't see why they're so important, because you can only find the diaconoi referred to in 1 Timothy 3. And maybe in Acts 6. And so I say, okay, all right, that's true. Now the presbyteroi and the presbyters are referred to not in Acts 20, 17, 28, but also in the early days, when Paul goes back to the very church that nearly stoned him as dead, or the area that he nearly stoned him as dead. And he appoints elders in every church. So he does in the early portion of Acts what he asks Titus to do in Crete. That's early on. That's his first missionary journey. Goes back to those churches. Circles back through them again. And every one of them points out that they're necessary to lead them in their spiritual growth and their full participation in the kingdom. See that when we look at the passage later on. Fundamental difference between the parallel instruction of Titus 1, 1 Timothy 3 provides one clue regarding this difficulty. Titus 1:5 suggests the church in Crete had been established only a short time and was still virtually unorganized. In such a situation, only initial rank of officers is prescribed, that is, the bishops or presbyters. Well, 1 Timothy 3 refers to both bishops and deacons. Apparently, as in Jerusalem with the apostles, it was assumed that in Crete, the bishops and presbyters would also care for the needy until such time work became too great and men qualified to serve as diaconal were available. Same approach was followed in Paul's first missionary journey, Acts 14:23. Look back at Acts 14:23. You can see that in the Roman language. The wonderful way it's described there. 14:23. And now, notice, Jews came from Antioch and Iconium, and having been split, crowd that stoned Paul, dragged him out, and they supposed that he was dead.
You know that person?
Think
he was dead?
No. Supposing that he was dead.
Oh, supposing he was dead. Okay.
But when the disciples gathered about him, he rose up there in the city, and the next day left all of arms to Derby. So that's all these cities, and Antioch, Iconium, Lystra, and Derby. And they preached the gospel of that city, and they then decided they returned to Lystra, and to Iconium, and to Antioch. And notice, in Lystra, where he has been stoned and been dead, he goes right back to that place. Strengthening the souls of the disciples, encouraging them to continue the faith, saying that through many tribulations we must enter the kingdom of God. And when they had appointed elders for them in every church, prayer and fasting, and committed them to the Lord in whom they had believed. So for the Apostle Paul, elders are so important that next to the gospel and salvation, he goes back and determines to establish elders on the church. But it makes no mention of deacons, because I think exactly like the Acts 6 phenomenon. And Titus 1, they are to serve until deacons are raised up and the need becomes apparent. The concern for the weak was still perceived as the responsibility of the bishops and elders in Miletus. Remember, it says in Miletus, talking to the elders of Ephesus, that they are to care for the weak, up to 20:35, we need to realize that this phenomenon is not simply speculation or guesswork on our part, it's seen as evidence. In all things, I've shown you that by working hard in this way, must help the weak. Know the word of the Lord Jesus, how he himself said, it is more blessed to give than to receive. So the bishops and elders seem to be responsible, even in Ephesus, for that responsibility. Until Paul, of course, tells them in 1 Timothy, they should go after deacons. Whether these men administer such hate or not, which we can't categorically say, but we can presume to be the case. The New Testament letters do not often refer to officers at all, Philippians 1:1 being a notable exception. Because the letters are ministering directly to the entire congregation through instruction and persuasion, and thus have very little reason to refer to officers. You need to put that in your mind, put it back there at the moment you can pull out. This is the reason that we don't have very many officers mentioned. Not because they're not there, not because they aren't crucially important to Paul. He put officers in four churches, and almost taking his life in his own hand. But because Paul is arguing directly with the congregation to persuade them from the teaching of the Word of God. He only mentions in Philippians one place. If he had mentioned them incidentally in Philippians, we would say he had no interest in the apostles at all, in officers at all. and destiny. When often referred to, it is usually in terms of their leadership responsibilities, and the significance of that in terms of the congregation's response, rather than in terms of diaconal duties. And we need to look at a few of these references. I mentioned them to you before, but let's look at them now. 1 Thessalonians 5, verses 12 and 13. We ask you, brothers, to respect those who labor among you and are over you in the Lord and admonish you. Now, if we were going to describe the work of the elders, presuming these are elders, we would have to describe them in three ways. They labor among you. They are over you. That's probably where we get the concept of overseers. And they admonish you. Obviously, rule, oversight, and admonition. And esteem them very highly loved because of their work. And here he only describes it as their work. Never even mentions what they are. Just be at peace among yourselves. We urge your brothers much. I'll encourage the faint hearted and help the weak, patient in them all. Words to that effect. So in 12 and 13, we have the elders described. They are mentioned again in Hebrews, but here in the Thessalonian letter, they are not described by title at all. But as we're going to come down and summarize later on, you will see that I summarize in later passages by talking about the different ways in which they're described, and those ways are used by the Greek terms that we find in the passages here. We'll get back to that when we get down to a minute. You can see, for example, I begin with 1 Thessalonians 5:12. We have koi istamanoi, which is a term that's picked up and used in 1 Timothy 3, 4, 5, and 5:17, where the bishops, overseers, and presbyters are called so. But in 1 Timothy 5:17, you just have a word used. And you're going to see a different word coming up in Hebrews. So let's look at Hebrews. Hebrews 13:17. Here we have the term used, not in this place, but in another place in Hebrews. Hebrews 13:17. Obey your leaders, that's just a generic word, and submit to them, for they are keeping watch over your souls. Now here's called watch over your souls. And those will have to give an account, and they're supposed to give an account to God. Let them do this with joy and not with groaning, for that will be of no advantage to you. And you may remember in another place in Hebrews, it does talk about those who are over them as elders. We won't turn to that right now. And then 1 Peter 5, 1 through 4. Here we find a general description of the officers. Having referred to them only as fellow elders earlier, so I exhort the elders, I exhort the elders among you as a fellow elder. And then notice what they're called on to do. Shepherd the flock of God. And you remember we had right up here pastors and teachers? And then we saw how he talked to the elders and bishops in Acts 27-28, the shepherd. Here that word surfaces again. But it's directed to all the elders. All the elders are to be pastors. Yes, Tim?
I guess just a comment. I noticed when we turned to Acts 20,
yeah,
that there, and I just saw the same pattern here, that in both places, in Acts 20 where Paul's talking to the elders as shepherds, and here where Peter's talking to the elders as shepherds, both of them develop that image. Here it's feed the flock,
yes.
It's guard the flock.
Yes.
And just it's pretty interesting because he's developing what he means by that word.
Yeah, it means teach, care for, and guard, yes. But of course, he uses the language of the shepherd, at least in my translation here, which is a lot more plain, and calling them the flock. So you see that full language, sheep and shepherd. And then notice how he said, exercising oversight. See, again, the whole concept of oversight there. And then the description of it, not domineering and so on, being examples for the flock. So you can see that the reason these officers refer to here is primarily because of what they should do or how the people respond to them, not simply to talk about them in any particular term. Therefore, those to whom the congregation is responded referred to, i.e. as leadership officers, there is no reason to refer to service officers. They're being referred to as what they should do spiritually for people, not how they should help people. Paul deals with that elsewhere, but not on the office terminology. Finally, there may be at least one reference to the diaconal office overlooked because a different designation is utilized, just as there are a number of other references in the New Testament leadership offices using other designations in the episcopal. 1 Corinthians 12:28 is the most notable example, and this is for both those who have some sort of office, that is, apostles, prophets, teachers, helpers, and ministers. Those whose gifts are not what would be associated with an office, that is, miracles, gifts of healing, and tongues. Leaving aside the foundational gifts of apostles and prophets, Ephesians 2:20 refers to that, shows that foundation. And the non-office gifts, we arrive at a threefold designation. Teacher, didaskaloi, helps, who can them, says, and administrator, kubanesis. We have seen from 1 Timothy 3 that the office of episcopos involves two duties, teaching, verse 2, and caring and ruling, verses 4 and 5. The parallel of the teachers and administrators of 1 Corinthians 12, 28, the account, which would be a designation for deacons. Likely, therefore, the Corinthian church had diakonoi, who were referred to as antilemphses, episkopoi, presbyteroi, referred to as didaskaloi, and kubernesis, referred to these reference guys as well. Episkopoi and presbyteroi are mentioned in the plural in regard to Ephesus, Acts 20:17-28, Philippi, look at 1:1, and each city church on Crete, Titus 1:5. Furthermore, Paul moves from the plural presbyteroi in Titus 1:5 to generic singular episcopos in Titus 1:7. From generic singular episcopos in 1 Timothy 3:2, the plural presbyteroi in 1 Timothy 5:17. This plurality of ruling officers is also seen in the reference to presbyteroi in Acts 11:30, 14:23, 15:2, 4, 5, and 22 and 23, 16:4, 20:17, 21:18, 1 Timothy 5:17-19, Colossians 1:17, Titus 1:5, James 5:14, 1 Peter 5:1-5, including 2 John 1 and 3 John 1, because they refer to individuals, not to a situation of church government. And the references in Revelation because of their symbolic and heavenly orientation. They are also the collective term presbyteroi, which uses another sense in first. No, that's in laying on the hand. In 1 Timothy 4:14. What I'm trying to establish in this section is that the New Testament church knows a rule and oversight of the plurality of presbyters and overseers. Does not know of a minister who is the elder, and of deacons, and that's the, does not know of episcopal monarch, it knows of episcopal and presbyteral. Now, there are a couple of references I showed you there in which the generic singular is used in Titus 1:7 and 1 Timothy 3:2, but you need to recognize that they are put in a context where the plural is used as their complementation. And we know that the plural is the leading factor. And the generic singular is generally used just to describe a particular officer as a standard for them. When attention is paid to this concept of oversight by a plurality of leaders, involving instruction and care. We ascertain that other passages refer to such a group using other terms that are synonymous to the slightly more frequent term episcopoi presbyteroi. For example, 1 Thessalonians 5, 12, and 13, where we have episkopoi, term used also in 1 Timothy 3, 4 and 5, and 5, 17. So it's enmeshed in the descriptions of officers in 1 Timothy, the two categories, the 3rd chapter and the 5th chapter, verse 17. So you know it's referring to the same responsibility of taking care and exercising oversight. In Hebrews 13, 7 and 17, hegumenoi, that is the people who are in front of you and are leading you. See for this term, prayer description of their duties. 1 Corinthians 12:28, didaskaloi, plural, kubernesis, plural, mentioned above. So these, by the way, 1 Timothy 5:13, it's the word there is used in the plural, and in Hebrews 13, the word there is used in the plural. I'm driving home this plural concept. All these plurals are used. And also in 1 Corinthians 12:28, the Duskin Loy, Hoy, and Hase are both plurals of those verbs, for those nouns. And then Ephesians 4:11, Poimenes, Kai, the Duskaloy, also plurals, not singulars, representing the twofold duties of the elders, the call of them to be pastors, feed and care for the flock, some of whom are particularly laboring the word and teaching. Again, Lightfoot is one of the best references I could give here. Maybe the one that I felt so good with a chuckle as I do it. But he doesn't say that who protects their family. Analysis of the data seems, therefore, indicate the existence of oversight by a plurality of church leaders throughout the New Testament church. Virtually every known area and knowledge are committed by virtually every New Testament writer who writes about church leadership. And what you need to do is you need to draw a map and cement this. People will say, "Oh, you Presbyterians, you just like to have a little knowledge." You need to recognize that you start from Jerusalem. Have elders recognize that. And by the churches that have been established from Antioch and up in the area of Paul's come from the church training. You have Eastern Asia Minor, where Paul goes back and establishes every church when he said he should establish one. And Western Asia Minor, the key central church there that influenced all the others, Ephesus. You have all of Asia Minor, all of the Palestinian area, including Jerusalem. You have the rest of Asia Minor mentioned because First Peter, in his first letter, writes to all the churches. Okay, Ephesus. Look at First Peter, first chapter, verses. I think it's right there in the first chapter, verse 1. Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. If you get out a little map of Asia Minor, you'll see that you're circulating, and you go, and you find those names and go, making a circle in Asia Minor. So Peter talks about it. Luke has already talked about it. Paul talks about it. And the writer Hebrews talks about it. Where did he live and to whom did he write? Well, maybe the church of Rome. I don't know. Then you go to Greece and you have over here Philippi that most distinguishingly says overseers and deacons. And you drop down to Corinth and you have teachers, helpers, and administrators. Now, mind you, we have almost gone over all of the area. We've had Luke mention it. We've had Paul mention it. We've had Peter mention it. We also have it mentioned by James. They call the elders and have them there, plural. also have it mentioned by the writer of Hebrews, and we just don't have them so clearly designated by the Apostle John. But he doesn't do much work. He does mention an elder, but he does in the singular, so special figure. So it's all the people who mention the detail: Luke, Paul, Peter, the writer of the Hebrews, the writer of James, mention this plural oversight. Now, if that doesn't persuade you, the geographical areas and the writers, I don't know how I can persuade you that the New Testament knows the rule of four group people. I would say it, but it being blind, put that in your pipe and smoke. We have the Apostolic Council, which means that all the apostles are agreed that they rule jointly with the elders. Finally, all the apostles agree that they rule jointly with the elders. And all the apostles agree that they can send a letter out from themselves and the elders, and that it should be heeded by the churches to which the letter is sent. And it's sent not only to one church, it's sent to several. And it is commended to be regarded. Look at Acts 16, verse 4. By the way, don't miss Acts 16, verse 4. It's a wonderful wrap-up of what was done in Acts 15. Now, you have in the 16th chapter, you have at the end of the 15th chapter, Paul and Silas depart, went through Syria and Cilicia. Paul came also to Derbe and to Lystra and so on. And what he does, look at verse 4. As they went on their way through the cities, they delivered to them for observance the decision that had been reached by the apostles and elders who were in Jerusalem. So the churches were strengthened the faith and increased the number of men. That meant that all the churches that he went back to, not only himself, but Silas and others, every one of them went back, taking this decree. And the decree says it's from the apostles and elders. I would think we were almost of mind to believe that maybe the whole apostolic church recognized the rule by apostles and elders. But we want to give ground for the independents and the Episcopalians, but I think they're on the edge of the table right now. In terms of the church governance. Every church in which leadership is referred to in Asia Minor, either under Paul and his associates, under Peter's ministry, is a plurality of leadership. Acts 14, Acts 20, 1 Timothy 3, 1 Timothy 5, Ephesians 4, 1 Peter 5, Note 1:1, the province of Asia Minor where they address these men. Key churches of Achaia and Macedonia have such leadership. That is Philippi, Thessalonica, and Corinth. I hadn't mentioned Thessalonica before. The island of Crete is urged to establish such a pattern, Titus 1, 5, and following. And the communities written to by James and the writer of Hebrews know the same pattern. We may assume that Barnabas continued the same pattern that he and Paul had established in Lystra, Iconium, and Antioch, Acts 14, when he returned to Cyprus. And I failed to mention here, which I should have mentioned, the gathering in Acts 15. I mentioned it earlier. I presume that's adequate. Only Rome and its geographical area provide us with no explicit information because Paul's letter does not deal explicitly with the subject. It may well be that Paul's very general list of personal gifts in Romans 12, 6 through 8 implies a similar approach in 1 Corinthians 12, 28 in terms of didaskon, and the Apollonia. And probably you should look at that just to see if that might persuade you. Anyway, Romans 12, 6 through 8. Having gifts that differ according to the grace given us, let us use them. Prophecy and proportion of faith. If service, that's the Apollonia. In our servant, the one who teaches, that's the didaskon. The one who exhorts in his exhortation, the one who contributes in his generosity, the one who leads That's proiskamenos, which is used in 1 Thessalonians to describe the elders and bishops, and used in 1 Timothy 3 and 1 Timothy 5. So maybe I spoke too soon by saying Romans doesn't know about it. Because then you'd have the threefold office, and the offices are put in three categories. In the midst, of course, of other things, it's not necessarily referring to offices in Romans. Since the pattern of twofold ministry and plurality of bishops and elders found in pastoral epistles, as in the rest of the New Testament, including Paul and his other letters and Acts, why was it necessary for him to speak of these ministries to trusted colleagues, especially to Timothy, in the several situations in Ephesus? Titus 1:5, in its reference to the fact that Paul has already directed Titus to do these things, points the way to the answer. Seems to be Paul's long-standing practice to reiterate or call for remembrance things that he has taught and wants to be practicing. In this respect, 1 Timothy 3:1 is similar to Titus 1:5. This pattern of recalling earlier teaching is seen throughout his writing from the very earliest. Compare 1 Thessalonians 4, these verses, 2 Thessalonians 2 and 3, Galatians 3:21, especially Philippians 3:1. Let's look at Philippians 3:1. That's a special one. All right, Philippians 2. Someone read that for us? I'll read it. Finally, my brother, rejoice in the Lord. To write the same things to you with no trouble to me and is safe for you. He knows he's writing the same things. He said to them, he said, I'm going to do it because I need to speak the truth for you and you need to hear the truth speak. I think that's a summary of Paul's attitude about repeating things, which means he's willing to do it. Then he thus recalls, that needs to be fixed. He thus recalls, every now and then you see something in another edition. He thus recalls earlier teaching, especially appropriate in an unorganized situation on the island of Crete. So that Titus and the churches might have the qualification for officers in writing. So Ephesus has had a Christian church for some time. Seeing that the problems had arisen there with reference to the elders, 1 Timothy 5:19-25, which may have been the catalyst Paul put in the qualification for officers in writing to Timothy. It's also possible that since Paul was writing in general about the way in which the church was ordered to conduct itself, 1 Timothy 3:14-15, may have felt it was appropriate to put into writing for his young associate for the church qualification for it. May also have been appropriate when he's asking Timothy to do that. And already he had to warn Timothy to not let someone look down on you. Gentlemen, I think you probably, and I as well, need a break. And he says, if you do that, you will be a good servant of Christ Jesus. But there are two things that make you a good servant. Not only how you share what the apostle has revealed to you, but how you are personally trained in those same works. So you need to be nourished or built up or trained in the words of the faith. And notice how he uses plural there, the words of the faith. That's why we spend so much time with individual words as well. And of the good doctrine that you have followed. You'll be a good servant if you train this way and then also put these things before the Lord. Now, I didn't say anything about it last time, but there's an interesting statement that he gives next, which says, in effect, have nothing to do with irreverent silliness. It's interesting that what he really says is have nothing to do with profane or godlessness, and that he uses the word graodes, which is a word that literally means, in the New Testament, apa, characteristic of old women. It's a sarcastic epithet which was frequent in philosophical polemic and conveys the idea of limitless credibility without carrying any negative overtones about either age or sex. You see that Paul doesn't agree that we should treat people derogatorily because how he insists on how we should encourage people, fathers, older men as fathers, younger men as brothers, older women as mothers, younger women, sisters in 5:1-2. I think we just ought to recognize that he's picking up on a word that's become a kind of maxim and saying without meaning it literally. Not saying older women are silly or they don't have any sense. But he is working on the fact that it seems that throughout the centuries in various cultures and so on, people have gotten this idea that this is an old wives' fable. We know the way to stop hiccups or the way to get over flu is to do some strange thing, which probably their mother and their mother told them, which has long ago been overturned in the medical community, but people, because they love their own parents and grandparents, are still holding on to it. In that sense, there's a credulity. Paul may be reflecting on that, but to say that about older men or younger women as well. But he does make this interesting comment about that which is characteristic of older men. Now, right after that, he begins to talk about athletic imagery. I told the men yesterday, and this is the section which reminds us of our call to be Olympians. We should not be lagging behind. We should do all those things that Paul, in all his writing, talks about. Whether he had just appreciated athletics, whether he's been an athletic himself or down there, he's always talking about running the race, winning the prize, not being left behind, straining to exercise yourself. I mean, he takes the physical imagery and makes it a part and parcel of his writing. And the one who probably has done the most work on this subject, let's see, I have his reference here, is a fellow named Fitzner and his Agon Motif. You can look him up in the top part of the commentary and the list there. V.C. Fitzner, P-F-I-T-Z-N-R, calling the Agon Motif, which has a subtitle, Traditional Athletic Imagery in the Pauline Literature. It was a Novum Testamentum supplement, number 16, published from Leiden in 1967. It's probably got one of the most up-to-date treatments in this. You may not always agree with him at every time, but he'll certainly fascinate you in going over this material. I think the saying that he utilizes here, which talks about rather train yourself for godliness, while bothering is that somebody of godliness obey in every way, holds promise for present life and life to come. Either I think it begins with the middle part of verse 7. All the train yourself for godliness, or at least at the beginning of verse 8. There are two possibilities. Amen. Now, unfortunately, there are some commentators who take these verses here and they associate it with asceticism. I can hardly see how they do that because it seems so physically and athletically significant. But there are a good number of doing that. The problem is, if they do that, it seems as if, and they also take the understanding, while bodily training is of some value, that they're acting as if Paul is backing off on what he said in verses 1 through 5. That's asceticism. And now you say, well, it may have some value, but not much. I think we should recognize that he is pitting spiritual training over against athletic training, in general terms. And when he's talking about bodily training, he may be talking about the fact that you do the bodily training may have some value, but its value is insignificant when compared to the bodily training. And just to make a kind of categorical and off the cuff comment here, if you get up early to do two things, to exercise and have your Bible reading training, and you come to the moment of truth in a certain particular morning where you can do one or the other, there should be no, I'm not talking about what you can make up and do later today. One or the other, this time of day, this is going to be true for the whole day. And it seemed to me, this teaching of Paul will tell you that you need to spiritually feed your soul rather than spending time doing exercise. Mind you, I'm not telling you shouldn't exercise. I think exercise is a great thing for you. Because you get older, and you have heart problems and so on. But it is of lesser value, certainly. It's a foil statement here over against the other. And the foil statement, unfortunately, can be read one or two ways. I'm talking now about verse 8. You can either read it's of some value, or you can read it is of very little or no value. See, it says, for bodily training is profitable for little. That's what it says, literally, for little. Now, you can either translate that absolutely, is not profitable for anything, profitable for nothing, little. Or you can translate it as profitable for some little. But then see, you're putting something in there when you put between the cross and the holy God an idea of some. And it seems to me that the ESV, which I have here, has gone that way. While body training is of some value, it seems to me that it would be much better if they translate body training as it's profitable for little. And then let the reader figure out whether that's some value or nobody from very little money.
Wouldn't it be here like a good rule for the interpreter or the even the translator to move away just from the strictly linguistics approach, because the linguistics approach would just say a little.
Yes.
But if we move away from that a little bit and look at where the force of his argument is going, besides just the sentence structure, I think it would win his whole argument. It's not saying don't do this, but
compare.
Compare these two, because he uses the but afterwards and says, but if the other one's little, he really has nothing to. If it's worthless, then why is he even making a comparison? I mean, that doesn't make any sense.
Very good.
But if you just stick to the linguistics, then you don't have anything.
Well, you're saying that the grammar should not help you to understand the linguistics. Your point you make as well is that it has to be enough for foil to be set over against the but. That's right. God is profitable for all things. That's right.
Because if he's going to use his training like he does elsewhere, like where he says, I bring my body into subjection, or I run the race to win a prize, all that would be negated just by this right here, if this is worthless.
Yes, that's right. And so I think probably some qualification, and that probably is what gave, I'm glad you brought that up, that's probably what caused them to translate this, rather train yourself while bodily training is of some value. Although they don't use the but, they understand that it is a false statement, which is going to be contrasted by God is the value of everyone. Very good. Now notice when he makes the comparison here, he talks about it's valuable in every way. And so he's not only saying it's valuable for much, he doesn't use for much as we might think he would, but he says pros. Panto for everything, for in all times. And then he qualifies that by saying, having promise of life, the now life, and the future life. Yes.
You're translating Alpha. No, never mind. You're right.
Ophalimos.
I was thinking that was a different word. I don't know why. I was thinking it was one yelling on it. It's not.
It's
something else. I was trying to figure out how that fit the context.
It says having a promise of life, the now, and life in the future. Okay. We're all learning Greek. We never really stop learning Greek. We don't use it. We don't speak it. We look at it at times.
Well, that's comforting.
But you should always remember when you're learning a language that you're learning more than what you feel you're not learning at all. Because when you get to the second, third chapter, you feel like you've lost part of the first and second chapter. But the real thing you should think of is the glass is getting fuller. Not it's getting empty, even though it's not full. Yeah, there are all these ways because language is merciless about you. It makes you always feel you're behind. You're behind everybody else in the class, and certainly behind the teacher. As a matter of fact, you're doing pretty well.
Yeah, my feeling's not quite there yet.
I don't want you to be ebullient, so overjoyed that you think you're like, saying, well, you're not doing the work.
I want you to do hard work
learning the words and the end and so on, but to cheer up your downward side as you're working hard. Put it all in context. Okay. I wasn't giving you just a one-sided perspective
here. It's a little work for me. I'm all good.
Well, anyway, I don't think you should put anything that was said earlier in this context of Little Prophet. You can talk about athletic imagery. You can talk about what bodily exercise might do for his body. But he particularly wants to emphasize what working to godliness will do. Now, Ritterbos had an interesting comment here when he talks about godliness as something that you should be working towards and what you're working out of. Ritterbos, in his commentary on the passage, which unfortunately still in Dutch, but I'll give you a kind of paraphrase for that. On page 197, Ritterbos suggests that pros we understood indicate that Eusebion is that in which one exercises, and not just that toward which one exercises, seems to be correct. So I don't want you just to read it, exercise yourself in godliness. I'd rather have you understand or exercise yourself from godliness, understood towards godliness to be accomplished. So that you don't always act as if you're exercising is bringing the godliness, but is exercising what Christ has already given you is going to give you more of that which you're seeking to gain. Yes?
Dr. Miller, would you flesh out a bit what this looks like practically? You mentioned devotions. I think we have some idea of this, what spiritual disciplines are, but taking this athletic imagery and relating it to our training ourselves in godliness. I guess I'm wondering if you can kind of flesh out the significance of that image for our...
I think it means that you should always be eager to learn more about the truth revealed in the Bible concerning the personal work of Jesus Christ. So what is it? How does he want to form and shape me? And how has he done that by the work of his Spirit? And how am I to utilize what his Spirit has done and is doing in me to grow further than that. And I think you should sometimes concentrate on that in a more systematic way, some of this as you're reading the scripture and going through. For example, I think you should take the fruit of the Spirit, line those fruits up, determine that you understand the meaning of each of those, and determine where you are in the fruit of the Spirit, and which aspects of the fruit you're weak on, which aspects you're strong on, which ones you ask for God's grace and enabling power to develop. And then you need to work on that. If you don't have joy, you should ask the Lord to give you joy, and you should be in seeking to express joy if you are not a joyful person. And the more you express it, the more you'll be developing in this life and for the life to come that characteristic which Christ wants to shape and form in you. So you should see what Christ has done for you. You should recognize that He is the enabling force in your life. You should see where He, what things He's calling you to develop. The imperatives and the ethical lists. Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, because the Lord works in you to will to do the one good thing. Remember, that's a double-sided statement. Here's what you should do. Here's what God has and will do. And you can be sure that you can do this, because He's the one who's going to do it. That's the kind of dynamism that keeps you going. Otherwise, you say, I'm saved. And if you're saved, it works. You do, but no, you're running the race. So he is not.
I'm just going to